That is the episode title. Hey guys, what is up? We are the Story Crafters. My name is Jeff. We have Nicole and Jared here with us. Charlie is unfortunately dealing with 5 levels of exhaustion. That dude works too hard. Everyone go message him. Let him know you love him. We're the Story Crafters. Welcome to the show. I'm sorry, but Jared just hit us with something that's definitely going to be in the front of this episode. Guys, how the heck have you been? I know everybody's been crazy busy.
Crazy.
What have you guys been up to? And before we get into that, let's roll initiative, shall we?
Let's roll initiative. Oh my goodness.
Oh, there it is.
The blooper reels just keep getting better, y'all.
I can't do it.
I was pre-rolling my dice, trying to get all the bad rolls out of the way, and I rolled 2 nat 20s in those. Now I rolled a 6.
Okay.
So the world is still in balance.
That's understandable. That's understandable. Nicole, what'd you get?
I got a 7.
Guys, we are crushing it. You ready for this? Yes. I got a 2.
Oh, God.
That's
terrible. And we're back.
And we're back, guys. And this is what happens when a bunch of DMs make a podcast.
Yeah.
Nicole, what you been up to, girl?
Yeah, what have I been up to with my wonderful 7? Oh, my gosh. I have been up to actually a lot of cool things this time. I still working on getting all my Etheria products out there and fulfilling my Kickstarter orders. Today, at recording time, is July 17th, and today was the first day that my Kickstarter backers could get access to the ebook version, which is super exciting. So the book is officially out there to at least 45 people. I think there's a few extras that I threw it out there too, because of their participation in making it. But the book is out there in its digital form, which is pretty cool.
How does that feel?
Oh, I am excited. I am nervous. I feel like I'm like putting my little baby out there into the world, and I'm scared that people are going to not like it, but I think people are really going to love it. So I'm excited for them to love it.
You can send all of your complaints to me, and I'll just go ahead and dismiss them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the quality control center is done by the Story Crafters. So
Yeah.
Guys, I fully support that. Also, I don't mind constructive criticism. I just don't want people to be mean.
I don't think anyone's gonna be mean. I mean, the book is so freaking cute. It's for kids too. It's like, dang, guys, come on. If anyone's mean about that, geez.
Right.
If you had to go and look back at your, like, when you're going back thinking about the book that you've done, is there any particular, like, moment or anything like that like, really stood out to you the most when you were making this?
This is a very random
question. I just like, let's do it.
Yeah, no, I keep thinking about this, honestly, because as I look at the book over and over again and talk to people about the book, I keep like coming back to this one moment where I really like pieced together the story. Obviously, I had the idea for the story for a while. I knew who the characters were going to be. I knew like the basic flow of it and kind of like some little lessons and little pieces that I wanted to incorporate. But I think I was like driving in the car. I do really good thinking driving in the car.
Oh yeah.
I was like on a drive from Austin to Houston, and I just kind of started like talking out loud about like, okay, well, we wanted to kind of be like D&D, so there's definitely going to be like a dungeon crawl aspect to it. So, okay, how does that fit in? And what does that look like? And what are the different like rooms of the dungeon? And why are they there exactly? I kind of feel like that was like the moment that it all came together. And I was like, okay, dang, it all fits. We have a plot. We have a plot, people.
That's cool. That's cool. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. That's when it actually became like a real book, I think. And then shortly thereafter, I just happened upon Daniel, the Drawing Bard's Instagram page, because we have a mutual friend through Heroes of Evermore. And I was like, yeah, you're going to illustrate my book. That's exactly the style that I want.
It is such like a unique and beautiful art style.
Yeah.
That it's like, I truly don't, not that I'm super plugged into all that, but it's truly like such a, you see something that the drawing board has done, you're like, I know who drew this.
Yeah.
Which is like so cool, you know?
Yeah. It definitely, he definitely has his own style and I love it. I'm here for it.
I love it too. I love it too. I always tell people like, oh, we know this really great illustrator, but you can't have him.
Do you know, do you have a firm, no, not a firm, because I'm not going to put that on you. Do you have an idea for a release date for the physical?
Yeah, I do. Actually, I was going to get to that. So the physical books are being printed right now. I think they'll be done printing in about a week. Around like the 24th, 25th of July. They should be done actually coming off the printers and being boxed up. And then it's probably going to be about 4 weeks for them to ship to me. Release date of like when people are actually going to be getting their physical books is probably going to be early September.
Nice. Yeah. That's great, like, though. I mean, that's
going to be the really exciting day. Like, I cannot wait for people to hold these books.
Yes. And that's perfect because that's when school starts for all the kiddos. So they can go to school with, you know, they can be like, hey, my mom and dad or whoever, my uncle, brother, something, friend, whatever, I don't care, read me this really awesome D&D children's book.
Yes.
I'm so excited for it.
I'm so excited. I can't wait to, like, actually get all the books. I have my physical sample, which I showed off a little bit last episode, but you know, it's not like the final product, right? But like, it's exciting. But I still want to see like the final with all the fancy stuff included. That very exciting.
Oh man, well,
so when's work on the sequel start?
Work on the sequel has started. So a few things are happening kind of all at once. So there's two, I guess you can call them prequels that I've already written part of. And they are backstories for two of the main characters, Dale and Ren.
Nice.
So I already have those partially written. Those are probably the next books that will be published. But also, I'm still working on the core game book for the Adventures in Etheria game, which will probably be the next like big thing I publish. Is like the game that you can actually play with your family.
That's really cool.
That's so fun.
Good. That's a big one.
That's so cool.
Manufacturing a game is much harder than manufacturing a book, I'm coming to find out.
It makes sense, because I think even like planning a game session, there's so many more elements to that than you realize at the surface. And then actually making a physical product that's going out to people, I can't even like begin to process what that's probably like.
Yeah, it's just so, it's so many like little pieces that all need to be right in order for it to make sense. But it's coming together.
That's all right.
Still kind of hopeful that I'll have it at least available to pre-order before Christmas.
Awesome.
Dope.
Okay. We won't hold you to it, but
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Good. apart from Etheria news, I did actually get to play D&D and run a game, which was super cool.
Ooh, nice.
We had some out of town friends come stay for the weekend and they brought their three children with them, so we sat down and had a nice probably three and a half hour session with some breaks over the weekend, I guess 2 weekends ago now, and that was super fun. We did just some random stuff in Etheria that we kind of made up on the cuff, and then we finished out the I'm going to butcher the name of it. It's the mermaid adventure from the kids' table, the 15-minute D&D mermaid adventure. It's like under the sea adventure or something like that. It was super fun. We had started that one and then just hadn't come back to it.
Sure.
So we did kind of a like, and to recap, these things happened and now you're here. And so what do you do? So we finished that up and it was it was really fun. That was a fun one. I cannot get enough of the 15-minute D&D adventures from the kids' table. They're so good. They're so well thought out, and they're super easy to prep and run, which I think is what parents need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I feel like that is honestly the perfect amount of time for an adventure, because then you can expand it if you need to a little bit. But like, there's no way, like, I know how my kids are. There's no way that it's getting done in 15 minutes. You know, like, it's going to be, if you get it done, like you just said, if you get it done in one sitting, that's impressive. So,
right. And at least the ones I've done so far are structured in like 5, I guess, 15-minute chunks. The chunks, because I tend to be kind of a storyteller and embellish and add extra stuff into it, the chunks end up actually being closer to like 30 to 40 minutes. And then each like adventure package has 5 of those different sections in it. So it ends up being a pretty decent amount of time if you're playing with a group of kids. So.
Right.
Highly recommend. It's a great like $3 to spend.
Yeah. Shout out to the kids table. Go support them. Do everything. They're awesome.
Yeah, they're amazing. They're really good people, and they make really good quality products for playing with kids.
That's
and
fun.
You know who else makes really good quality products? Firelight Fables, the sponsor of today's episode. Light a candle and explore the senses as you can delve into the sights in your mind, the smells in your nose, and you can become immersed with your Firelight Fables candle. Use code STORYCRAFTERS for 15% off your order. Back to you, Nicole.
I love it.
It was smooth.
It was really smooth. Also, just like,
I do this for a living.
No playing around. Firelight Fables is amazing, and you will be disappointed if you order their candles.
Like, they are, yeah.
It's not just a pitch from us. It's not just a pitch. Yeah. They're so good.
They are so good. They're absolutely insane. I have Mermaid Lagoon and Cursed Sails right here. Boom, boom.
I have high seas, right? It's up out of reach because it's, you know, high seas, not low seas, but it's up there.
Bunch of other ones, too. Sense. Bunch of other ones over here, but...
I'm definitely cheating today. I'm repping a local artist candle. I don't have my Firelight Fables right next to me because I've been enjoying this cafe latte one from an Austin-based candle studio.
That's awesome, though, too. Support local people.
Support local people, yeah. we do a little bit of both around here. So. One more thing before I turn it over. I got these really cool... I don't know why I always show stuff. I know most people are not watching. But I got these really cool little, like, tiny...
Because it's fun for the ones that do watch it.
Potion bottle thing. They're so fun.
That's so cute.
So they're called Alchemini's. And I got these from Hilliard Hall Games, who I'm friends with on Instagram. They make a lot of cool books and... D&D supplements and adventures, but we've been talking about these little like cute potion and poison things for a year. And I finally got mine in the mail, and I'm super excited. And says they're made in Colorado. I didn't even see that. That's really cute. But yeah, they make these, and like I said, they make a bunch of other really cool D&D and I'm not going to stuff those back in there right now because that crinkling noise is annoying. But yeah, check out
separate audio now.
Check out Hilliard Hall Games. I'll leave their Instagram in the show notes, and I don't think they're selling those quite yet, but I think they're going to be on their website soon, and hopefully in retail stores soon too if you want your own little cute tiny potion bottle.
Yeah, that's so fun. I love it.
I feel like those are the perfect handout too for like the players at your table, and just be like, you now have a health potion, here you go, as a reminder that you have one on your person, you know?
Right, because we do always forget these like invisible items in our inventory.
Right. Yeah.
I love a cute little practical trinket. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
But,
that's anyway, so fun.
I think that's all I've got. What about you, Jared? What have you been up to?
I've actually gotten to play. I thought I was going to come onto a recording and be like, I haven't played D&D at all. But actually, I've gotten to play twice now in the last week. So that's been fun.
Oh, wow.
First, on this past Sunday, I got to go be a player with the Theater Geeks group that I joined that streams on Twitch in our Journey to Ragnarok campaign. That was a lot of fun. We set sail across a strait and got attacked by some undead things that somebody decided to fish out of the bottom of the sea. So that was unfortunate, but it turned out to be a pretty fun session.
That's what you do when you're
definitely go check out Theater Geeks. It's a lot of fun. They stream every Sunday pretty much. And I'm just part of the one, but they're a fun group. And I appreciate getting to be a player every once in a while, because it is it's a whole different animal than DMing. You can just show up and have fun and enjoy. And, you know, it's a really good time. It's been so long since I've gotten to play a character that's recurring, you know, because I'll get the opportunity to play a character in a one shot here and there, but it's never the like, you know, the investment isn't there on my end as the player, because I'm like, I'm not concerned what happens. It's a one shot. So it's really fun getting to dive back into being a singular character that I care about, you know, that I'm worried about their longevity and all those things. So that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that. And then secondly, I got to run a one shot for a local Goshen, where I live, Goshen Pride group. They celebrate Pride in July, I guess. Or in, yeah, it's July now instead of June. I guess you can celebrate it any time of the year. So that's cool.
Yeah, all year round Pride. Got to go,
right, yeah. Got to go run a one shot at an event the other night, and that was a blast. I had five players. First for me, I had a player get up partway through and they go, I'm bored, so I'm going to go. And I go, that's great. Love that for you. So that was actually kind of hilarious. And it was actually fun. It wasn't really discouraging at all. It was just like, you know what? I can respect somebody who knows what they're about. They very much wanted to attack and kill everything that presented itself. And that was unfortunately not the vibe that I had prepared. So, but it was a lot of fun. All my characters were little rabbit folk that were venturing into the Wibblewood forest to save the feast, and, you know, had to get the carrot cake and all the stuff and fight some squirrels and an owl bear and stuff. So it was a blast. It was a lot of fun.
It's so cute.
I saw the minis on your Instagram. Did you paint those?
I did. They are designed, really, I'm going to butcher the name, so I apologize in advance. It's Tyne Felding is the name of the designer. She posts on Instagram a lot. Very, like, whimsical. Definitely, I'll send it to you to put in the show notes, Nicole.
Definitely
go check out their work, because it's awesome. So yeah, I saw those as I was trying to, like, figure out what I wanted to do for this one shot, and I saw those. I'm like, there it is. There's the whole idea. So yeah, those were super fun to paint. Thank you. Appreciate it. They definitely looked better in the pictures than they do in real life, I think, which was a fun thing. But if I can't self-deprecate, I don't know what to do. So, but no, they were a lot of fun to paint. Not terribly complicated minis, which was a lot of fun, because I feel like so often, because I'm honest to God, still not super efficient and great at painting minis, those were a lot of fun because there wasn't a ton of detail on them. So it didn't take terribly long, which was great because I definitely procrastinated a very long time. So yeah, they were a lot of fun. Happy with how it turned out. It was a fun event. Definitely a one shot that I'll probably reuse at some point and, you know, continue to explore it a little bit just to see how else it could play out. But so that was a lot of fun. I've been extremely busy, so I've not really done any crafting. That was the extent of, you know, painting those six rabbit folk, and then I painted three squirrels. Has pretty much been the entirety of my crafting time, probably over the last month. So,
you did that whole thing for the UK Expo or whatever. Or what was it? Yeah, UK Expo.
Yeah, the UK Games Expo.
I would still be burnt out from doing that. Like,
still riding that that burnout train pretty hard. But that's fine. It's always good to have small bite-sized projects like painting a few minis to, you know, kind of dip your toe back in. So, but yeah, I mean, that's been me. Beyond that, not a whole lot.
Yeah. I have played D&D once this past, I actually played last night. But I haven't painted a mini. I haven't crafted anything since the last show that we talked about. Because I've been very just busy in life again. Like, actually, like, taking the things that I used to, like, really love. I got back into writing music, so I'm writing a record again. And that's taken up a lot of my time. So it's going to be interesting. But I do have plans to paint some minis and stuff this upcoming weekend. And we played D&D last night, and it was awesome. I was down two players, so typically I have five. We were down to three. And it was... It's really fun. We have one guy, we're all super close friends. Then we have one guy who he's never played before, but he's played a lot of RP games. This is the dude that like flanks people that I didn't think he was flanking to get flanks. That is awesome. But he's role playing this character to be kind of this like standoffish Verdant. And it is the most hilarious thing. But at one point, me and another player, like he's kind of my co-DM. Like him and I have like swapped off. Like I'll play, and then he'll DM to do like a story bit and stuff like that. Which is actually how Cargrim came to be. What was I saying? I'd laugh about this just thinking about it. The one of my players, my friends, he is playing an artificer, and he likes to thunder punch a lot of things, including doors, right? Well, thunder punching in a dark, decrepit dungeon is loud, and he kept doing it to open the doors. I was like, yeah, I mean, you're obviously going to hit the door. I mean, you're going to punch the door. Just roll your damage real quick, so see how badly you blow this thing up, you know? Well, the player, I'm not going to do names or anything, but the player who was playing the Verdant, he was starting to get like kind of in character annoyed that he kept, that he was like not trying to like stealth or anything like that. So they got in a fight with two animated armors, and I almost downed.
So they woke up by punching the door.
No, actually, they were stagnant until someone touched them. And there was a whole mechanic where I'm kind of if you are listening to this, guys, you get a little foreshadowing. Ha ha ha. But there's going to be shadow versions of themselves. And I'm starting to foreshadow that by like the ranger went and he looked into the like he lifted up the helmet of one of the animated armors. And I described it as like this like. Fey demon type thing, like these gnarly teeth like shrouded out of the animated armor's like mask and stuff, but it looked like his character just with these like gnarly like huge sharp pointy teeth for you Monty Python fans. So I almost downed one of the guys. They decided to take a long rest by clearing one of the rooms, boarding the door, blah blah blah. Well, on the way in, player Thunder Punch, right, went and took his long rest. The guy who was getting annoyed didn't need a long rest. He got 1 point of damage done. The other dude was on 2 hit points. He goes, as I walk by, I put my arm on his shoulder and I cast Sacred Flame. I was like, exactly, Nicole, you have my face, and Jared, you have my other friend's face. He starts laughing and I go, wait a second, what? And he goes, uh-huh, I cast Sacred Flame. I said, well, he's asleep, so that's an auto hit. It's not an auto crit because he's not restrained, but it's an auto hit.
Yeah.
Okay, roll your damage. They're level 3. He rolled an 8. Just he rolled max damage. So he downed another player while he was asleep. And I'm like, I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, oh my God, this is about to turn into PvP. I am not prepared for this at all, really. Mentally. And in my heart, I'm not prepared for this. I was like, are you about to kill one of the people at the table and I'm not even the one that gets to do it? Like, right. And so he does that. And I was like, okay, You're down, dude. Roll a death save. So he rolls a 10, so he succeeds. And then I look back and I was like, I look at the other character, the third guy, and he was like, he's like, I'm sleeping, bro. I'm like, okay.
I'm just still sleeping. I'm staying out of this.
So I looked back at the other guy. I was like, what do you do now, dude? Like, are you going to continue to sacred flame him? He goes, nope. I cast healing word on him. I was like, what is happening here? So he brought him up, and then I went back to the other dude. I was like, all right, you're obviously awake now. And the whole point of it was this, like, it was this weird, I mean, it was awesome in character on in the table. Like, he's like, you need to stop doing that because he's our tank.
That's incredible. Like,
and I was like, you've never played D&D, but this is session 8, dude. Like, right. So it's a very much like the way that this is happening for those who watch Critical Role. It reminds me of Chetney and Dorian, like where they just like butt heads at the beginning, but by the end they're like super tight. And I'm like, okay, this is the really cool part about D&D that I love is like, yeah, there's an overarching story, but there's these small little stories that get woven into the bigger picture that it's just like, man, that's the good stuff right there. You know,
really, as a DM, I think there's nothing more satisfying than being able to like sit back a little bit and having your players interact in character with each other and like doing things that don't involve NPCs or you as the DM at all. It's literally the best.
From where they've come, like to where they started to where they are now. I literally like almost had to railroad them. So like my first campaign I did. And now I'm at the point where I built a full set for a fight that I thought they were going to go to. And they completely went in a completely different direction. And it was a freaking fantastic session. And I'm like, I'm so proud of you. It's like a little proud mama hen. Like... I haven't really, besides just playing D&D, I had to pick up another shelf because I have way too much crap. between all my Warhammer things and D&D stuff, I have 6 shelves now, chuck full of sorts of plastic things that bring me all of the serotonin. But that's what I've been up to. With that,
not me, so, like counting my shelves over here. I'm like,
I know, right? Right.
I was just thinking, what's that like being organized and having things sitting on shelves and not just like precariously piled one thing on top of the other?
I am organizing my shelves this weekend because I am doing a room tour video that is coming at some point too. Yeah. That's gonna take a while though because I do want to do it like really nicely. That'll be on the Storycrafters YouTube because I'm not making my own YouTube channel. Absolutely not.
For all those listening, room tours are like my favorite thing to watch of game rooms and, you know, crafting spaces. So do that and send them to me.
Okay.
We will. Agreed. I feel like if there was like, I don't know, I'm going to age myself and I'm older than y'all, like MTV Cribs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If there was like that, but for like gamer nerds,
you know,
I would watch. Oh, yeah. I would watch the crap out of that. If there was that for like gamers, I'll be so happy.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
I'd be like, show me your nerd stuff.
Get nerdy with me. Okay. Oh, that's a segment there. Let's get nerdy. Anyways. We're going to leave here just for a second while I get my thoughts together on our lore. If you are one of the people that actually do pause in between different sections of our show, we're going to pause real quick here, take a break, go get a coffee, go do whatever you need to. We're going to come back and talk about the Sword Coast. We'll catch you in a second. Welcome back, guys. Hey, hello there. What's up? How's it going? Guys, today we're talking about the Sword Coast. Everybody plays D&D at some point. You're going to go into it. Whether or not you're running through the Lost Mines of Phandelver, the Dragon of Stormwreck Isle, the Storm King's Thunder, the Descent into Madness. No, that's not there. That's in the Yawning Portal. No, that is, because that takes place in Waterdeep, which is also in Dungeon of the Mad Mage. Not Descent into Madness, Dungeon of the Mad Mage. All of those... all take place in the Sword Coast. So let's get into it. A land of windswept cliffs, misty forests, ancient ruins, and bustling cities, the Sword Coast stretches for hundreds of miles along the western edge of the continent. It's a place where legends walk, gods whisper, and the veil between the mundane and the mythic grows thin. The Sword Coast is bordered by the Sea of Swords to the west, and the towering Sword Mountain and the spine of the world to the east. It's not a single kingdom or an empire, but a loose collection of city-states, independent settlements, and dangerous wilderness. Here, power is earned through cunning, coin, and conquest. Let's kind of get into a little bit of the Sword Coast. We're going to start with some of the major cities that are here. And we kind of talked about it just for a second there. And I've talked about it before in the lore section of Waterdeep, also known as the City of Splendors, which is the jewel of civilization. It's the largest and most powerful city in the Sword Coast, ruled by the Masked Lords, because again, nobody knows who is actually in charge of Waterdeep. It's all that, if you remember back, I think that was episode 4 or 5. I'll double check that. But there is nobody really knows who is in control over Waterdeep. All of the magic, all the politics, it's all hidden. And then beneath it lies the Undermountain. Insert Dungeon of the Mad Mage here. The legendary mega dungeon ruled by the Mad Mage, Alistair Blackcloak. And, well, you'll have to go into the Yawning Portal and, you know, look down that actual mine shaft to see what lies beneath the Undermountain. We're going to go a little bit more closer to the video game world here, and for those who are familiar with Neverwinter, a once-shattered eruption of Mountain Hotennau, Neverwinter has risen again, rebuilt under the rule of the Lord Dagult Neverember. I probably butchered that name.
Sounded good.
The city remains, even though it's been risen again. And there, it's in forests that whisper of fey creatures, and the ruins outside the city are also undead and worse. There is a field that is outside of it. I believe it is by the name of the Field of the Dead, I think. That is basically just a bunch of undead that wander around Neverwinter. You can see Neverwinter if you are a video game player. You can actually play the, like, it's an MMO like World of Warcraft called Neverwinter. And you can actually see what that city looks like. It's actually really fun. I played it a little bit on PlayStation. But I would be
remiss. It's on Steam and it's underrated. It is on Steam.
I would be remiss. My in-ear keeps coming out of my ear. I would be remiss if I did not mention the prized possession of Dungeons & Dragons video games. Baldur's Gate. Guys, the gateway to the south. Baldur's Gate is the gritty port city that is ruled by merchant lords and underworld syndicates. It's grimy, it's gritty, it's gross. It is a city of shadows where back alley deals are as common as sword fights in the street. It is also the birthplace of many heroes and villains. And I'm not here to tell you one way or another about how you play your Baldur's Gate, but if you ain't trying to romance them people, come on. Come on. And last but not least, of course, we have Luskan, the City of Sails. It's a little bit more of a piratey haven, so this is more up Jared's alley here. Luskan was once a proud city of magical learning, but today it is ruled by the Arcane Brotherhood, a cabal of wizards vying into control of ancient secrets. A few ships sail into Luskan without good reason, and few leave untouched by its dangers. But what lies beyond? Of course, everyone wants to know the cities, but what goes beyond the cities? Well, you have the Mere of Dead Men, M-E-R-E, Mere. I think that's how you pronounce that. A vast swamp haunted by undead creatures and curses. This is the remnants of a king of kingdoms drowned in their own ambition and tales of dragon bones beneath the muck. Could you imagine if you're actually going in there and out of nowhere a black dragon swoops out from a swamp and just hurls acid at you? We have the High Forest, which is once ruled of an elven kingdom of Erlan. E-A-R-L-A-N-N. I can spell.
One of those.
And this forest is still watched by the Emerald Enclave. Druids and rangers who protect the balance of nature. If you do play druids, you will kind of see that come up every now and then in your lore, that as you're creating your character, the Emerald Enclave. And then you have the Deseran Valley, a land once peaceful and is now the site of elemental upheaval. The cult of elemental evil stirred not long ago, as far as the timeline goes for Dungeons and Dragons. But it ripped the land apart, bringing these monoliths and ancient relics with it. That I actually need to look into myself more, because it sounds really interesting. But I don't honestly know a whole lot about it.
Right.
And even
is this
myself,
like a tectonic plate situation? Like, what is happening here?
It's cool. It's basically a torn apart region.
That does sound cool.
Now, who created
I'm like this? Such a visual person as we're talking about this. I just like have the map of the Sword Coast pulled up and I'm like, oh, look at that. Look at this. Yeah. Look at that.
Yeah. And I would say if you're ever struggling to like, if you're trying to do something homebrew, but you still want it to be placed on the Sword Coast, like just pull up the map and look around and have another tab of the, I just lost the name, the wiki, the D&D wiki. What is it called?
Forgotten Realms wiki.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And just like type in, because that is where I found so many. Like our lore in episode one, the purple rocks, never would have known if I wasn't just like zooming in on the map and finding, you know, such a great resource.
Yeah. So we talked about the land. What about the sky daddies, the things that the gods, the giants, everything? The Sword Coast is not just a stage for mortal ambition, but the gods themselves play games here, guys. Temples to Timora, Lathander, Missandra, and Bane line the streets of almost every single major city. Clerics perform miracles and warlocks walk among the common folk bound by mystery patrons. And then there are the giants. The Ordnig, the divine hierarchy of giant kind, was shattered. The Sword Coast shook as the giant lords began their crusades to seize power as the villages burned and dragons fought giants in the sky. And one ancient power, a storm giant by the name of Hecaton, vanished, leaving a kingdom behind in chaos, which I believe is the start of the Storm King's Thunder campaign. I believe. I could be wrong about that. But I have played it, and Hecaton does come up in it. Now, from the rugged coastlines of the Morshay Isles to the frozen tundra of Icewind Dale, the Sword Coast is a place of eternal adventure. Whether you're a sellsword from Baldur's Gate, a harper's agent in disguise, or a wide-eyed apprentice from the roadside hamlet, the Sword Coast has a tale for all of you. It's a crossroad of power, a tapestry. Tapestry? It's a tapestry! I don't know what that was. It's a crossroad of power, a tapestry of intrigue, and above all, a reminder that in the Faerûn, stories are carved with steel and sealed with magic.
Ooh.
So, the next time your party finds yourselves tattered in a map with the phrase "the Sword Coast The next time your party finds a tattered map with the phrase "to the Sword Coast" scrawled across the top, don't hesitate. But you may want to check your coin purse first. And that is the Sword Coast, guys. It is an awesome place. It is filled with lots of story and intrigue. I suggest everyone who's playing in that just do a little bit of lore research into it, and you will find that your game becomes significantly more immersive if you kind of have an idea of where you're at. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. Questions, comments, concerns? What do we got going on?
Many. So many.
So many.
I feel mostly like concerns, but... I'm sure I've talked about this on Storycrafters before, but I feel like I'm like one of... definitely us, but like maybe few people that are so into Dungeons and Dragons and running games that has never actually played in like a WotC scenario ever. Like, I've never played a game or ran a game in anything but like third party content. So I'm always like super excited to hear about like the actual Wizards of the Coast D&D lore, because it is so good. It is so good.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I don't like running the modules that they make. I don't know why. I have a hard time following them. Like, feeling that locked into a book, I'm like, I don't know. I'd rather just homebrew it, or like homebrew it in the world and use use the world as kind of like a springboard of where to go.
That's what I find too. Yeah, I agree. I find that true of me too with pre-written modules. I feel like it's almost nerve-wracking for me because I'm afraid I'm going to mess something up that like comes into play later. But I love taking settings that are pre-established and either saying like, this is just set in a different timeline, not, you know, not multiversal timeline, but just like, this is in the future or in history or whatever. And, you know, being able to take tidbits of lore, like even in my homebrew world, the Oceanic Vale is the whole map, and I've just kind of said like, you know, if you eventually sail north far enough, you're gonna hit the Sword Coast, you know, because it like has the same pantheon and all of that stuff. So it is such a great tool to like build lore into your worlds and then create your own adventure from there, you know.
Yeah,
love that,
man. Guys, that was a fun lore section.
That was great.
Yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed that. For listeners, I hope that wet the whistle, as they say, for your intrigue into some Dungeons and Dragons stuff. But I'm going to stop yapping now because we have things to talk about that we did not talk about last episode because we had such cool things to talk about then. But this time, guys, we're going to talk about puzzles. Our favorite ones, how we use them, why we use them, do we use them? Let's find out. Nicole, start us off there.
Yes, we use them. I use them. So, as all of y'all know at this point, I'm sure, I exclusively run games that have kids at the table. Sometimes it's all kids. Usually it's like a mix of kids and adults. So the puzzles that I use are typically things that I think are going to be very, very simple. Like, could a four-year-old do it? That does not always turn out to be the case. I cannot even tell you the number of times that I have like made a puzzle and brought it to a game thinking, oh, even the four-year-old will be able to do this. And then the adults that are playing are like, I can't figure out how to do this.
Have you had it where the adults can't figure it out and one of the kids kind of swoops in and be like, clearly it's this.
Clearly.
Yes. Dumbass. Yes. Yes, I have. But I was actually last episode, I was kind of going through some of my D&D stuff and thinking like, okay, well, what are some of my favorite puzzles around? And then also just like generally for those of y'all that either play with kids or want to play with kids, like how do you adapt puzzles down to an age level? And let me talk about the second thing first, because I'm looking at it right now. So this is like a hot tip. People may not like me for it, but the easiest way to get a puzzle for a game with kids is steal from like pre-K and elementary school curriculum. So for example, if say there's a mock chest or something that requires a numeric code, I might give my kids a puzzle that's like literally a counting page out of like a pre-K homework book, or like one of those like, don't let your kids experience the summer slide, do this workbook while we're out of school for 2 months, like those kind of things that no one actually ever does. So for those of y'all watching, stuff that looks like this. Really simple. Whoa.
Okay.
Like, a four-year-old can do that, right? Uh-huh. Okay, we add up the things. Then we have a code. We input the code. The chest opens. Easy.
Hmm.
Is this fun for an adult? Not really. But that's okay, because it's meant to be for the youngest of the kids at the table so that they can participate in a puzzle, which is really exciting for them. Yeah, they're free. They're all over the internet. Just type in Google pre-K or kinder or first grade or whatever level you're dealing with, activity sheets or something, and come up with a whole bunch of different versions of something like that, where you have to work out this very basic mathematical or verbal puzzle to get a result. Steal, take that. Don't make your own.
Advice. I remember running a game for my kids, and it's been a couple years now, where before I had physical terrain and stuff, I was like, I really wanted to do a maze, and I was struggling, and I literally just decided that I printed out a maze on a piece of paper and I laid it in front of them, and I literally just had both of them solve the maze with pen and paper, and kind of did like an overarching narrative of like, you guys are, you know, exploring through, and if they hit a dead end, then you kind of talk that through, and literally just give them a piece of paper and let them do stuff. That's great advice.
Yeah, I've done that too. Printing out mazes are awesome. If you have kids who, I just did this in my last game. You have kids who like are a little too old to be super interested in those like just little printed out mazes, then you can tell them that like as they're drawing the line, like their character's going down a hallway and like the walls are electrified. So you have to make sure not to like touch the pencil to the walls. So then they have to be more careful as they're charting their path. Like, I mean, that's as we all do,
idea.
Just make stuff up, right? You just make it up to make it more fun. But yeah, so I do a lot of that kind of stuff, a lot of stealing from teachers who put their stuff online. Thank you, elementary teachers. You are amazing people, and I don't know how you do what you do, but you are the best. My favorite type of puzzles to do are puzzles that are basically like a kind of a play on a jigsaw puzzle. Also, side note, I use jigsaw puzzles sometimes, like just a puzzle from a box. And I'm like, here's this 50-piece puzzle that you have to do now.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Done that before, too. That's kind of fun. That I like to do things like this. Again, I'm showing a lot of stuff, so I'm sorry, audio people.
That's okay.
I like to print out pictures that are kind of like weird. Like this, you can't really tell right now because it's not all put together, but this is like a skull with some like stained glass kind of stuff.
That's cool.
So,
yeah.
Like mandalas and stuff like that are really good for this too, or like tessellations and stuff like that. Print out the picture black and white or in color depending on how easy or hard you want it to be, and then just cut it in strips. Just cut it. You make your own puzzle. These are really hard for adults, I have come to learn.
Believe it.
What do you... I'm curious, if you have that and you print that out for your table with adults, what do you do mechanically or anything like that to make it so they don't just pick an end and just build the paper back? Is there anything you do, or I guess it's per puzzle?
I mean, I literally, like, the mechanical thing I do is I hand them the strips.
Oh.
And then they just put it together.
Hmm.
Or the squares or whatever way I cut it into. Mm-hmm. It's not as easy as you think it is.
Okay. I'll have to try.
Well, and I was going to say, I mean, you could do that and even have like a piece in a different dungeon room, you know, and spread them out and have them gather them to get through like the main door. Yeah.
That's maybe you don't even know how many pieces there are.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe keep the last piece in your pocket just to, you know, mess with them.
Right. And honestly, because I'm kind of lazy and haven't thought of better ways to introduce this, usually I do like a, I feel like I stole this from Skyrim or something, but I'll be like, oh, there's all these like random stone tablets and you have to figure out how they fit together. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's definitely a story behind it, but it's a pretty, generic story.
I think puzzles work like that well in video games. And I think if you can just translate those directly onto your table, it works great. And if you are in person, you can have that physical prop, or sometimes you can just describe it. But I think, like, don't overthink it, you know?
No, I think the worst puzzles are the puzzles that I overthink, because they just end up being, like, impossibly hard.
Yeah.
So some of my favorite puzzles that I've put together as a GM are things that I was like, is this too easy? This may not even be fun. It may just be so simple for them to figure it out. But feels that way because you're the one coming up with it. When it's like translated to someone else's brain to figure it out, it ends up usually being a lot harder.
It's like knowing the answer to a riddle. Once you know it, it's not, you know, it's not a mystery anymore. But I think it is, truth be told, one of the things that I am lacking the most in my DM tool belt is puzzles in my games. And I think now, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking about it now, I've definitely done it more for my kids because I think it's more approachable. And I don't do puzzles that often for my adult players, and I should, because I think I've done exactly what Nicole just described. I think I've done a few and I've made them either way too complex or so singular that it's like I'm dropping breadcrumbs, you know, but it's like I remember I had a door that had a riddle on it, and it was complicated, but like with the lore of the world and the surrounding area, it was solvable. And I remember, you know, my party was sitting there and I had the rogue trying to use his thieves tools and he rolled a nat 20. I had my artificer trying to do something, rolled a nat 20, and a wizard also rolled a nat 20. So it's like I had three nat 20s on this one door. And so I'm sitting there like, well, nobody's solved this, but I can't let three nat 20s go. So I'm like, yeah, you got it. You know, and I think that there's probably the like middle ground there of maybe a puzzle has multiple solutions depending on what it is, you know. I think it's one of those things that I think Nicole hit it right on the head. I think don't overcomplicate it. I think sometimes straightforward is better. And if it goes quick, then so be it, you know. But I, as many other people have had, I've also just had literally a door that is unlocked and my players spend an hour trying to get through a door that was just could be opened the whole time. So it is one of those things, much like a battle, you know, if you plan a combat, it might last a round or two rounds, or it might, you know, it might last 10 rounds and take 2 hours of your session. You know, it's definitely something that I need to implement more in my games, though, is more puzzles and not be afraid to like present things that end up being easy because you never know what's going to hit and what's not.
I'm kind of the same way. I didn't really use puzzles in the first campaign I ever ran. I started to a little bit in my second one, but this third one I am definitely doing puzzles a lot more, because my players all got used to just like combat, and I was like, all right, cool, like let's change it up. And I started throwing puzzles at them, and man, they have gotten very creative to try to solve these things, but I'm really bad at coming up with puzzles because I don't think that way. And so what I typically do, and I have a book for one thing, the Dungeon Master's like traps and puzzles and encounters book. I forget what it is. That's amazing. Use that book. But also, I'm sorry, I use ChatGPT. Coming up with puzzles like that. And what I'll do is I was like, hey, here's my idea. And I'll give it like the idea of what I want the puzzle to do. And then it'll spit the mechanic out for me. And if I like it, cool. If not, I'll change it. But Jared, you nailed it exactly what I was going to say, is most of my puzzles have multiple ways to solve them. For example, two sessions ago, my players found themselves in a cave, like cavern room that had a door that revealed itself at the end of either the puzzle or the encounter. In this case, they kind of triggered the encounter by messing up the puzzle. And so I had 7 water droplets that were dropping from the ceiling at all different intervals. The idea was that they were supposed to find the rhythm and then replay that rhythm, right? Which would cause the door to open. My ranger in the party, he is, I don't even know what kind of ranger he is. I need to actually look at his character sheet again. But he's got the abilities that let him have bees that are, he's basically like the beekeeper from Marvel. Essentially, like, he's just got these bees constantly all around him, and he's got this queen bee in his hat, right? In his like Van Helsing style hat, similar like Ratatouille, right? But terrifying. And he was like, you know what? They struggled. He's like, how many are there? I said, there's 7. He said, how big are those? You know, make a perception check. He looked and found out that they're small water droplets. He's like, all right, I'm going to command my bees to go and plug those holes. And I was like, ooh, okay, I didn't think this. So I ran with that, which then triggered them because they broke, quote, broke the puzzle. Well, that caused the 2 stone giants to fall down from the ceiling, which is what would have happened if they had failed the puzzle. So it was like, okay, like, so you, they got this like sense of validation that they did something that triggered another event to happen that wasn't just like a, oh, you stepped on the wrong block, now, you know, the roof falls, you're all dead. You know, they got creative with it and used the bees to plug the holes. And I was like, well, that's way cooler than what I had. Like, that's awesome. So we're going to run with that.
And I think an important note is that, like, I think that is probably part of why I don't do puzzles, because I'm always afraid of something like that happening and then being super creative and then being so stringent on it and blocking that.
Because you don't want to kill the creativity.
Exactly. And I think that is the perfect example that you just gave, Jeff, of just like reward the creativity. If it still makes sense, maybe have a fail safe in place, or maybe just have something that can happen, you know, maybe like a stone golem or something that can still continue it, you know, without necessarily having to sit around the table for hours with people getting frustrated, you know, like, trying to solve a riddle, trying to, you know, did I turn this statue the right way? Is that one, you know, I think that's excellent.
The other one that we ended up, it was a room of 2 puzzles on this. I'll make this one quick. The doorway before then was this hallway. And basically what has happened is they had went this direction and they went underground. They found this dwarven like runic tunnel. They started following it. Essentially what they've done is they've ended up in the basement of this, it's called the Ruins of Thornhold, but they've ended up in the very lowest section of the keep, which was not supposed to be entered. It was only supposed to be exited. So everything that they're doing seems backwards. And so the one room floods. And so I put this riddle over the door that I thought was really simple. Those who carry the water may enter, right? They were right next to this frozen lake that attached into it. My thought being, okay, those who carry the water, they'll go, they'll chop a piece of ice off of the iceberg thingy, whatever their glacier, whatever those things are called, ice caps. Have one of the dudes light on fire, turns into water, boom. And then I described how there were these like 4 like fish heads on the walls with their mouth and eyes open. And the idea was they fill the fish heads with water, the door opens. I thought it was super simple. These dudes took so long to try to find this that it got to the point where I was like, okay, like if they started messing with stuff. I was like, all right, I got to get the momentum going back here. So in the middle of it, they're like, they tried something, like the one dude like hit it. And I was like, nope. But you do notice that, you know, the liquid begins to fall off the side of the walls, because they were underground and they were next to a lake. So it made sense that it would flood. But then they're like, all right, well, I take my hands and I push in the eyes. I was like, okay. You push in the eyes, like, and it kind of like recesses, right? It's like, all right, they're clearly going off of that. So let's reward that a little bit. And I kind of like change the mechanic right on the spot, because it's like, okay, you guys found something cool that's still challenging yourselves as players. And so it's like, why not just run with it? So DM tip, let your players kind of determine without them knowing that they're determining the outcomes.
And the great news they're
making
that
they're making their own puzzles at that point. It's like, thank you for taking the load off of me, please. Thank you.
The great news with that is if they go in a completely different direction, you can just slightly reskin the same puzzle.
Exactly. And leave the rocks falling and stuff like that. You know, that's all well and good. That all deserves, you know, you have that in every dungeon crawl. It's a classic, you know, don't break what isn't broken, you know, or don't fix what isn't broken. It's late.
Yeah.
Puzzles are cool. I'm starting to like them a little bit more. I like riddles. I do like riddles. I think riddles are fun. I do love the good old classic Monty Python troll under the bridge. You know, how fast is a swallow? You know, give me those all day. Those things are fun. Anyone got anything before we close them out?
I think just what I'm taking from this is don't set in stone what you're going to do, and just kind of go with the flow.
Except like, if it's set in stone. Interesting.
But yeah, unless it's etched in, which is, it's so funny that I'm thinking about this now, because it's just, or not that I'm thinking about it now, but I'm typically so flexible with everything else in D&D that it's funny that is not my mindset when it comes to puzzles oftentimes. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Ooh. I'm definitely going to, be looking to introduce more puzzles in my story, because they are fun, and it is a change of pace where it's like you can get some dice rolls and some cooperation between players without it always being combat or always being RP.
Yeah. So
that's fun. I'm excited about it.
Man. That was a good episode. That was fun.
Yeah, I like it. I think puzzles are definitely... I mean, maybe Charlie is, I'm not sure, but I feel like it's not like any of our like bread and butter to do puzzles, but it add that like extra flavor to the game. And
Well, it's a cool mechanic. It's a pillar of it too, for sure.
Yeah, I really like that kind of concept of like rewarding the creativity. Like, I mean, I've definitely done that. I guess I didn't realize I was doing it, but I've definitely had puzzles that I set up that I thought were going to go a certain way and they did another way. And I was like, yeah, that works.
Yeah,
it would. Right. Yeah. But like, that's really cool to kind of like let them run with it. And, you know, like you're saying, Jared, like we do with everything else, right? It's this collaborative world building thing. Why can't the puzzles be collaborative too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially if the players at the table don't even know that that's what's going on. Like, if they think that they like, and that's not a slight to you players out there that are listening to this going, Jeff thinks that all players are dumb and rah, rah, rah. No, it's like y'all come up with the coolest things, and because we're trying to make a fun experience and a fun game for y'all, and then you guys come out swinging. It's like, why don't you DM this thing, man? Like,
no,
that's way cooler than what I come up with.
One of the things I'm most excited about is whenever the Abyssal Tides ends and I can have the like reveal all my cards and be like, this person wasn't a thing until you guys made him be one. This wasn't a thing. This, you know, because it's like there's so many things that it's like you never know what your players are going to grab onto. And then you just like in the moment make it, you know, become a thing. And it's it's so fun.
Yeah.
So fun.
Yeah. Any last minute comments here before we wrap this up? Because, man,
we did it.
Yay.
I would be remiss if I didn't make a New Girl reference and just like put out the Winston doing puzzles things. That's how I feel as a player whenever I'm presented with a puzzle, is how Winston from New Girl does puzzles. And if you don't know, then go watch the show because it's a great show. So,
yes. Gosh, I forgot about that show. Man,
it's a great show.
Not the cute my one.
Goodness. All right. Guys, we are at the point of next episode topic here. Does anybody have a D100.
Yeah, I got you.
Can roll.
I got you. Because I don't have a physical D100, but what I do have is this Time Stop D20 watch that I can roll dice on. So shout out Time Stop. I'm going to roll two D10s. Whoop. If I can press the right button on my watch. That is a 53.
A 53. A 53. Do we have the list?
I was just looking to see if it got added to the Google Drive, but I do not think
Did
so.
Charlie do it yet? No. So. All right, 53. So that is. Yeah, we'll get back to you on that one. Man, what a fun time. Charlie, we missed you, bro. We're looking forward to see you on the next one. But from all of us at the Story Crafters, I'm Jeff. We have Nicole and Jared and Charlie, even though he is not here on the screen or in the audio, he is here in person. We are the Story Crafters. We love you guys very much. Thank you so much for listening and all your support. We'll catch you in the next one. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Daddy's home.